Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hi, everyone. This is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is Wednesday, August 12th, and I'm very excited to be bringing you a joint production with my friend Joel Bine for School Sucks and for his podcast, linked in the show notes. If you want to learn more, and you do, Exponentially Empowered, it's an excellent collection of deep dives into a wide range of personal development topics. Joel, I would say, in many cases, has taken some of the stuff that we've done on School Sucks even further. Topics like internal family systems, the six pillars of self-esteem, and other work by Nathaniel Brandon, communication, critical thinking, relationships with others, relationship with self, a lot of self-nurturing practices like journaling, and of course, entrepreneurship. This was a very nice way to celebrate the 11th anniversary of School Sucks. It's certainly a conversation of reflection. Joel started listening to the show back in 2009 when he was 21, and obviously that is a part of our story, and I feel like this is long overdue having Joel on the show. It's really wonderful and gratifying to have a friend who has put into practice so much of what we have preached here for over a decade, and to see the positive results. So many of these ideas have yielded for someone that I do consider a good friend. It's nice to know what we do here was some part of that, or some, you know, motivation for taking that journey. So I have endless appreciation for Joel's commitment to and engagement in the work we've been doing here all this time. We formed a collaborative relationship. Joel did some fantastic writing for me on personal development topics that you will all be able to read soon. But a big part of his story, Joel spent most of his career, most of his adult life, as a school teacher. In fact, he has one brief, but I would say memorable, prior appearance in the School Sucks podcast feed. And the fact that this is his only appearance is kind of a travesty of justice, because it was a conversation that, no fault of Joel's, I actually found very agitating. You can hear my agitation if you go back and listen to the recording. It was from Renegade University and School Sucks Project present a weekend with Thaddeus Russell, New Orleans, live and interactive podcast. And just in a nutshell, go back and listen if you haven't heard it, but I really appreciated Joel's authenticity in discussing how he felt he was unable to obviously align his actions with his values in that job. And I felt like my co-host wasn't doing a good job of listening. And then there was some yelling. But even back then, even back in, what was that, May 2018, he was on his way out. He was in search of a career that he felt would bring him a greater sense of personal integrity. And recently, he found it. Just a couple of days ago, he announced that he is not going back to school. Joel had been participating, I think, for over a year now in the CRASH program that we just talked about on the show. Joel and I talk privately pretty frequently. And, you know, we both acknowledge that it is a challenging time to be changing careers, trying to get your feet wet doing something you haven't done before. But this August, what a month, August. I said in the last monologue that Joel's birthday is the anniversary of the first episode of School Sucks, August 5th. He decided he was going to put together a pitch for none other than friend of the show, Isaac Morehouse. On Facebook 2 days ago, Joel wrote, "Life update. I'm excited to share that I've started a new role with CRASH, an early stage startup helping people discover and do what makes them come alive. Replacing the resume, job hunters send video pitches with a portfolio of projects to land roles at companies. It's empowering and creative. The mission is meaningful in helping the world become freer and happier. After pitching over 20 companies as a customer user in the past 12 plus months, I chose to pitch the company founder, Isaac Morehouse himself, who has influenced me incalculably in my creative and entrepreneurial mindset the past 4 years. When they weren't hiring, I pitched Crash because it makes me come alive to help other people come alive. I'm now contributing value via sales, customer success, and content creation, blogs and podcasts, and any other way I can as we work with purpose to scale and become the best job hunt platform in the universe. So this marks the end of an era teaching in K-12. The chapter closes in my personal story of seeking to meet the needs for authenticity and integrity, to be who I am, to align actions with values. Because from the beginning of my career, I fundamentally disagreed with the school system. I worked passionately and purposefully, and I created meaningful memories and connections making music with young people. But with even deeper conviction, I dissected the roots of that system, listening to over 650 episodes of the School Sucks podcast over 11 years, finding the podcast while student teaching, hosted by my now good friend, Brett Vinat. School is not synonymous with education. For years, I hid my worldview. I hid my true self. I went along with the cultural premises and pretenses needed to navigate that system. The cognitive dissonance I experienced was hard. So hard. So much so that I wanted to publicly express thankfulness and gratitude for my past self. Thank you for pressing on. Thank you for the courage to take responsibility. Thank you for leaning into the discomfort of authenticity. Thank you for crying when you needed to cry. Thank you for executing on the daily habits needed to reinvent yourself. I hope you'll consider thanking your past self at some point too. But now, dare I say like John Galt, I've left that factory. I don't shame or blame the people who've worked in the school system. I understand what motivates them. But I also know how much better education can be for both kids and adults. So now I choose to criticize by creating. With Crash, we want to make the credential system obsolete. Projects, not degrees. Value, not checking boxes. Creativity, not obligation. And will I remain a musician? Absolutely. New Orleans Chamber Players will carry on with beauty. So for 5 years, I've chosen a metaphor to inspire my personal and professional growth. Become the butterfly by emerging from the safety of the cocoon. Burst through the walls to actualize the authentic self. And then just last month, butterflies appeared outside my home. Not only that, dozens of cocoons hung from outside of the front door. For weeks, I would open the door in the morning and see the freshly hatched butterflies, perched on their cocoons, wings contracted, ready to take the leap of flight. That, my friends, is called an omen. I've taken my leap, and I feel good. Thanks to everyone who has nourished my wings. So, congratulations, Joel. And I'm very appreciative, obviously, for all the motivation, inspiration, and support that you've provided me in recent years. In the show notes, please find the Exponentially Empowered link, add it to your podcast feed, go through the topics. A lot of it's familiar territory. Decide what you need some brushing up on, and please take a listen. All right, here we go.
Okay, I'm going to set the scene, flashback to September 2009, Poughkeepsie, New York, and I am sitting in my apartment near Vassar College campus. I just turned 21, and I was starting my senior year of college, studying education, music education, getting ready to get a credential to work in K-12, and I had just started my student teaching experience. I was working at a small K-5 elementary school, as well as a large 4,000 student high school. So at this point, I had loosely begun questioning the nature of the school system and sort of questioning the culture at large. But then in this moment, I came across this little website with a cartoon of a sad, frowny kid dragging his feet and about to enter a school bus. And this website was for a new podcast called the School Sucks Podcast. And I was immediately drawn in. And so I start listening, and this guy starts talking on this sort of raspy microphone about the hidden lessons of school, obedience, conformity, and apathy. And I just start eating it up. And, you know, I'm working at the same, as I'm listening to these podcasts, I'm working with these excited, inquisitive kindergartners, you know. At the same time, I'm working with sort of silent and passionless high school freshmen. And I kind of see what Brett, the creator of the show, is talking about in terms of obedience, conformity, and apathy, and how those things accumulate over the years in the K-12 experience. So I'm just hooked into this show, and I've been listening ever since, past 11 years. You know, but after those first 100 episodes, 2009 to 2010, School Sucks is not just about talking about problems. It really turns into a show about self-education, personal empowerment, philosophy, critical thinking. Brett's done amazing shows on trivia method of critical thinking, on logical fallacies, on the getting things done system of organization, six pillars of self-esteem, nonviolent communication, entrepreneurship, and numerous education alternative options. All this I've soaked up. My curiosity has just snowballed. I've really taken to heart the concepts of personal development in particular, and being the example for how you want the world to be. And that's sort of the, I mean, without School Sucks, I wouldn't be here right now with like creating this podcast, Exponentially Empowered, the idea of starting with yourself. And I'm really grateful to today have Brett Vinant, the host of School Sucks podcast, with me. And I'm grateful to call him a friend and really excited to talk to him about these ideas. Welcome, Brett.
Hey, Joel. Thank you for having me. I'm so glad that we are finally doing this.
Absolutely. So another memory was basically 2010, and I was listening to your show and kind of driving around New York State, and you had this episode about the spheres of control. And this was really the beginning, the seed that was planted for this podcast, Exponentially Empowered, where you're identifying, you know, it's easy to see these major systems of, you know, the Federal Reserve or any oppressive system of government, war on drugs, any of this kind of stuff, and then feel outraged and try to make change from the outside in, trying to disintegrate these systems through advocacy. You're arguing with people, and you had the show just identifying that, hey, that's really not much you can do on an individual level to make that huge impact directly, but indirectly, you can do quite a bit. And that was where you identified, you know, the different spheres of influence that you have. Focus on your health, focus on your financial life, focus on professional happiness, focus on relationship freedom, time freedom, your own self-esteem. And that, I think, in conjunction with sort of the second level, which might be connecting to your relationships and your community and watching that outgrow, you know, that's really the most powerful way. So I'm curious if you could talk more about that 2010 sort of moment for you and the influences there.
Absolutely. And thank you for saying the date several times, because I like the fact that we're getting it on the record that we were in before Jordan Peterson, Clean Your Room. Jake DeSillis and I did a show, I think back like over four years ago, called A Better World Starts with a clean bedroom. And that was years and years and years after this like turning point in the show that you were talking about. So I think my initial observation, and I obviously was not the first person to make this observation. I think it was Gandhi, or at least it's attributed to Gandhi, and it's become a very sort of cliched social change with personal development quote, which is be the change you want to see in the world. Where when I was young, and I think this is happening to a lot of young people today, a lot of our energy and our attention is pulled away from ourselves, away from the spheres of influence that we actually have, into, yes, these distant things that we're going to be able to have very little power over as individuals, and the truth is, even as movements or organizations. So I found that I was substituting, you know, this responsibility to point out the things that were wrong in the world for actual personal growth, right? To feel like I was involved in some kind of important effort or important movement was in fact a surrogate for actually working on myself. And working on myself would have been a way to expand, you know, my sphere of influence to family, to friends, to community. But if all of that at that most inner circle is being ignored, then why would anybody listen to me? And honestly, what's my stamina for, you know, difficult work as far as trying to address complex, you know, social or political problems going to be if my own life is in chaos? And, you know, I started doing this show over 10 years ago to meet a need. To express myself, to say things that I couldn't say when I worked in schools and, you know, private education services. But I didn't really do it with personal growth as like an initial kind of project. I knew that school was certainly ignoring and exacerbating a lot of the damage to self, to the individual that really needs to be addressed and healed if, you know, we're going to have successful, happy, fulfilled lives. But it wasn't part of my mission when I started doing this. I really did, as the title that I've been stuck with for almost 11 years now suggests, it was focused on something very much outside of me and not for, you know, surviving and thriving in a world that is, you know, in many ways imperfect and challenging. And, you know, to be more cynical and corrupt and, you know, cruel in some ways. And those are the realities that we have to live with. So I think at some point I realized that the strengthening of the self was the most important part of trying to confront any of that stuff. And even if you don't get very far, it's still the most important work you can do, right? Even if the Federal Reserve is here when I die, I'm glad I put my focus where it was. And it took a long time. You know, I mean, I might have said that in 2010, but it took, you know, 4 or 5 years before I was really able to practice what I think I began to preach in that podcast that you mentioned.
Yeah. And I'm curious to dig in more about your growth experience in those areas. But first of all, I mean, just starting, the first year of School Sucks was more cynical for sure.
Sure.
But you just talked about how that was out of your own desire for just self-expression and as a therapeutic element to get things off your chest.
Yeah. I also think I knew, I think I had a pretty good sense of what entertainment was like as far as the show is political. It really looks at everything through a libertarian lens. It did so much more explicitly back then. And I think with the media influences that I had, which, you know, one of the biggest ones was a radio show called Free Talk Live. You draw lines. You say, we're on this side. This is our enemy. These are the rocks we throw. And that's kind of a setup that a lot of people are looking for if you're going to do something that has a lot of political commentary built into it.
Yeah. I would just add that even if it's cynical or political, the fact that you created the podcast was something productive, you know, because you're not simply debating on social media or even debating in real life with people who don't want to hear it. You're creating something and you are providing an opportunity to speak to people who are curious, right? Because the thing about podcasts is people are completely choosing on their own volition what podcasts to listen to. And you know that anyone who's listening is curious to listen. So it's a creative outlet that was productive in and of itself, even in the first year of the show. And then of course it started really focusing on the self. But I was curious about more about your influence of, about the sphere of control topic and personal freedom first idea. Stefan Molyneux, of course, and that's his earliest shows, Freedom Man Radio, were really about that. And his latest shows, we agree, are off the rails, and we don't advocate a lot of what he's saying politically so much these days. Sure. But those earliest shows, and that's how I found your show. You guys collaborated way back in the beginning. Those shows are all about personal freedom and talking about, you know, if your relationships are unhappy, then who are you to go talking about creating a free society when you're not free in your own relationships? And that was
or your family, work. Sure, yeah.
Was that something that was directly influential in this sphere of control topic?
Yeah, I think so. I think Wes Bertrand and I did a series called Wes, by the way, was also, I mentioned Free Talk Live. I should also credit Wes. And Wes was the guy who told me about Stefan Molyneux. But I should credit Wes as one of my biggest influences. I know he's a mutual friend. And he and I actually just talked for, gosh, almost 3 hours yesterday morning. He did Complete Liberty podcast, and that was how I actually got my feet wet. I sent him a message, I think, in 2008, and I said, can I audition to be like a co-host of your show? Before I even had, and I had a vision for School Sucks as kind of like a documentary film or series, but it just been shelved because I was discouraged for various reasons. But the message of Complete Liberty, which was, you know, while it alerted people to what the outside threats and impositions to freedom were, certainly. It also did have that personal focus like Freedom Main Radio had. So that message really resonated with me. Wes obviously seemed likable and accessible, so I reached out to him, and we did like 5 or 6 hours on the topic of education. And I think that was really, and then, you know, he invited me back as a co-host to talk about other topics. And that was when I was like, you know, I really got to get going on my own thing here. So my show kind of spun off from that show. But you asked me a question about
Sphere. More specifically about Stefan Molyneux's shows and his emphasis of personal freedom and relationship freedom.
And then that's how I got to talking about this series. It was called Escape from Imagination Land that Wes and I did, and it was in 2010. And I think that was like, you know, me saying or echoing that statement from Steph, and that might have even been something that kind of tuned me into that idea. Is it's like, wow, I'm being really critical of a lot of things in the outside world and so-called normal people and, you know, normal political thinking and functioning. But if I'm becoming more aware of some of the challenges that I'm having in my own life, like even if I think that I've really figured things out when it comes to politics or education or philosophy, there are some places where, you know, as a 32-year-old man, I am just completely lost. And I started to feel like there needed to be a more empathetic approach to the blind spots that I thought other people had, if I had so many of them in my own life, right? It couldn't be like 100% outgoing, you know, judgment towards other people. There needed to be like more self-reflection. And I think that was a really important turning point in the show for me, even though, as I said before, it definitely took a long time for that idea to yield results in my own life. But I think if I could just jump into this for a second, I do a lot of callbacks to those old times on the show when it comes to like cynicism or directing attention outside of a sphere of control, because this has been a very challenging year. And you and I have talked about this in our private conversations. But I think the original model that I kind of laid out on the show is like you have these outgoing spheres of influence, you know, yourself, your family and friends, your community. And then if you are able to be a person of influence through those spheres, then maybe you can extend yourself into larger projects. But there's another model or another visualization that I think is really useful for this. And it's about the difference between being proactive and being reactive. And I think the events of 2020 have really like pulled this back into focus for me. You have a circle of control, and then outside of that, there's a circle of concern, right? So in the circle of control would be like things like attitude, you know, your habits, what you're doing for work, what you're buying, what you're consuming, where you're living, the relationships you have, what you're putting in your mind, your body, you know, what all of those types of things. Beyond that, the circle of concern would be like, you know, the political views of other people, the news, what other people think of you. And when we have a year like this, well, not like there's ever been a year like this before in my life, but when lots of stressful, potentially traumatic, seemingly urgent things happen in the outside world, it's very easy for that outer sphere of concern to kind of close in
on your actual sphere of control, right? Like if the whole circle, the one circle inside the other, if the whole thing represents the energy and attention you have to devote in your life, the circle of concern can start to crowd out and squeeze in on the circle of actual control that you have. And so I just wanted to say that I'm really happy to be having this discussion because I think I've mentioned this on my podcast. I've felt that happening this year. I think a lot of people can relate to that as, you know, we've all done like social media detoxes and news detoxes in our lives, but this has been a particularly challenging year to devote what is, and I'm sure it's different for everybody, the right amount of time to that sphere of control and to have appropriate respite from that circle of concern. It doesn't mean you should never spend time there, but it's easier to spend more time there when there's a lot happening outside the circle of control.
Absolutely. And I've sensed that myself in 2020, the circle of concern closing in. And that's one motivation for restarting this podcast, creating season two, is I want to pump this message up. Because no matter what the world's doing, it's never going to be different in terms of your choice to choose. As Viktor Frankl said, you always have the choice to choose your attitude in any given set of circumstances. So yeah, there is a lot that is concerning. And I think a lot of people are feeling an exacerbation of, you know, frustration, worry, you know, uncertainty. And there's a lot of sort of flux or instability. And that's why it's even more important to underscore this message so that you can create a sense of groundedness and stability in your own, you know, own life, your own psychology. And that's going to be not only fruitful for you, but then you can be a beacon of light for other people. Cause it's not like this is at all the normal attitude to take. So if you can do it, then you're going to, you know, pass that torch a bit to other people. But, you know, it's, as you've said, as you've alluded to, it's not a message that is necessarily as marketable, right? It's really, you know, it's really marketable to talk about the political realm because everyone has a political opinion, right? And it's completely socially acceptable to have a political opinion, right? But if you have, I mean, I've experienced this recently, even talking to people, you know, voluntarists and free thinking people, where I start talking about something like, oh, I think the roots of all these problems is childhood adverse experiences. And if we, you know, let's turn inward and heal that and help parent our kids better. All of a sudden, like the atmosphere in the room changes, even though we've all been sharing all these ideas about the bigger picture, all of a sudden you start talking about personal empowerment. Whoa, it just got real. All of a sudden everyone's looking in the mirror about, okay, am I actually addressing that? And that can be uncomfortable. Mm. But I think leaning into that discomfort is really powerful, and it's going to be fruitful for you and your other spheres.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think as far as like trying to at least project a message, right? So we're talking about in media, you have to market yourself and you have to, you know, market your brand and your voice to a certain extent. And it part of marketing is building a tribe around what you're doing. And it is challenging. It's not impossible, but it's challenging to build a tribe without letting those people know that there is in fact another tribe on the other side of the hill, right? So that is almost an invitation in a lot of the types of media that we create. And it's like, I have to circle back to that and provide red meat, I feel like, to an audience about teachers unions or higher education, social justice warriors or the media, like those kinds of things. That's who's on the other side of the hill that's coming to get us, you know, so let's draw the tribe in close and make sure we're strong. Like that's always happening. So yeah, it is very, very difficult. And I think I would say Tim Ferriss has done a really good job of that, like having that kind of close connection with an audience without having to frequently remind them of some other. I think there's probably a lot of people in personal development, whether they're, you know, creating products or YouTube channels or podcasts, that are pretty effective with that. But in focusing on school versus education, there certainly is a lot of conflict in those arenas. So I do think there needs to be reminders about the things that hinder you know, freedom. I mean, that my mission statement, because like with anything, and even like with a lot of my habits or my commitments to personal growth, the passion and the commitment waxes and wanes over time. Like, I've been at this a long time. And, you know, when it wanes, I kind of go back to my statement of purpose, which is I want to help liberate people or help people liberate themselves, I think is a better way of saying it, from the things that make them unhappy and unfree. Well, what's revealed, I think, through the story of institutionalized schooling in the United States is there are collectives, there are people, there are projects, even if it is not in their mission statement, we're here to make people unhappy and unfree. The effect of, you know, things like public schooling and various aspects of higher education, and this even certainly extends into the professional world, it has that outcome. So we have to put some attention there. And I constantly find myself in this tug of war, trying to strike the right balance, because what's a trait, there's something that is to what you're saying about people's reluctance to look inward, right? There is something that is more comfortable and satisfying about looking outward, right? And identifying the defects in others. So it's easy to go there. And it's always been a very difficult balance for me to strike, to be like, okay, remind people that there are, you know, individuals and institutions and organizations that are interfering with human flourishing and human freedom, but make sure that we're doing enough work, enough content on how to create the strength to confront those things and persevere through whatever obstacle courses those entities set up for us in life.
Yeah. And I think you've done admirable work over the years striking that balance. I would say maybe, you know, 80% of the time you're talking about personal development and alternative education options and sort of trying to create a sort of solution oriented approach. But then you still touch on these problematic influences in the society. And that's also still relates to the personal empowerment, because if you are talking about critical thinking in interpreting media, basically media literacy, which you've done, I mean, an enormous amount of work on media literacy, and that is, and you're creating that intellectual self-defense. That is a element of personal empowerment, where you are now able to have tools to see all this information, especially now when there's so much information, even though it's talking about something in the greater society that also connects to the self.
Yeah, I think that intellectual self-defense is obviously an extremely important part of, you know, like focus on self, personal wellness, personal growth, because if too much of that bad material is in your intellectual or emotional diet, it's obviously going to interfere with, it's going to hurt that growth. And so it's not just like intellectual self-defense. I think it's also emotional self-defense when it comes to a lot of media, mainstream or alternative, and the, you know, the contents, and the toxicity, of those kinds of things. And I was telling this story, I do these, discussion groups several times a week for the university, which is a kind of an offshoot of School Sucks. It's we created a virtual summit last year called Ideas into Action. And so we have, you know, weekly get to, or Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we do get togethers and we can talk about, you know, things that people want, have learned there or have questions about, or they want to apply to the current chaos of 2020. Like, all of those kinds of discussions can happen. And I was saying in a recent one, I think last week, that, you know, sometimes I'll be on YouTube, you know, it's mealtime and I want to watch a little video to entertain myself while I eat, or to have somebody else entertain me while I eat, I guess I should say. And, you know, YouTube has that very devilish suggested video section right next to whatever you're watching when you're on the computer. And, you know, you'll see a video from like CNN or something. And I say, well, this will be amusing. And I have really good intellectual self-defense. So I'll be able to watch this as a kind of entertainment, right? I'll be able to watch this for the purpose of media analysis. But I'll watch it. And even if it's just like 5 or 6 minutes, I will certainly close it and feel worse, right? Because it's hitting you on some other level, on some more subtle subconscious kind of level. And I really feel for people who are watching stuff like that day in and day out, and letting that be the window through which they see the outside world. It was like, you probably just heard the show that I did with Isaac, where it was called All News is Fake News with Isaac Morehouse. And, you know, he said a perfect remedy for the stress or the anxiousness that you can feel as a result of this media consumption, you just go outside and the real world feels nothing like that most of the time. I mean, you can see glimpses and glimmers of it here and there, but it's a very, very important part of your diet. So yeah, I think that to create content focused on intellectual and, you know, that important pairing of emotional self-defense, like how do you process and protect yourself from these things that you're seeing, you have to show people those things. So yeah, I appreciate your input and your compliment there, that we do seem, from a listener perspective, to be striking the right balance. Because I never feel like I am. I always go back and say, oh, I'm doing too much of this stuff. I gotta get back to the good, productive, in my sphere of control type content. So
yeah, so let's highlight that more. And I'm curious if you could sort of illuminate for the listener some of your, maybe a couple stories over these past 10 years in terms of following through on that sphere of control idea that you planted in 2010. And I know you've done series of shows that, and sort of learning out loud for the listener in your own life, whether that's health and fitness or, you know, communication skills and nonviolent communication, self-esteem. But, you know, you can go any direction with this, whether it's health, financial, relationships, communication, time, freedom. What growth have you experienced in these past 10 years?
Well, I would suggest, and this is a particularly tricky one right now, but like physical fitness, physical health is, if people are at the beginning of this journey, or they know somebody who's at the beginning of this journey that they're, you know, aim, if people have, you know, gotten to this point with your podcast, they're on this journey, but they probably have outreach they want to do with people that they care about. And, you know, I have found embracing some kind of physical fitness pursuit is a really, really good place to start, because you do not see results like with any aspect of personal growth. The day after you start something, you do not see results. It requires a lot of hard work, and over time, the dividends definitely become visible, and not just in how you look, but in how you feel. And I think that, you know, so many of the practices, the habits that we try to build, you know, like take journaling, for example. Journaling could go on for 3 or 4 months, and at the end of it, 120 straight days of journaling, you could look at your journal and go, why am I doing this? It's a meditation. Is another one. Maybe by 3 or 4 months, you're getting some yield from it, but most people might not make it that long, right? So to have fitness as a foundation for a better life, like some kind of fitness pursuit, I think that's a really, really good place to start. And then once you see those results, you can say, all right, I have a model that works for you know, one type of growth or self-improvement. What else can I apply it to now? So I was into that stuff before I started this process. It was basically like the only kind of self-care or personal improvement thing that I worked on for a long time. But I found, you know, when I had some challenges, you know, in 2013 in my life, in 2015 in my life, getting active and moving my body and setting some goals and achieving those goals, it was the most important kind of reset to other types of growth and improvement. So I'd say that is a really, really key place to start. And obviously that also is building a kind of autonomy and ownership in this realm of health, right? To get more health freedom. If you do not take care of yourself, you're basically outsourcing the responsibility of putting you back together to others, right? To a system that is extremely impersonal and, you know, has various perverse incentives. I'm talking about, you know, the healthcare system in this country. You do not want to be a dependent on that. So shifting more into like, these are the things that I can take ownership of. And, you know, that would be like diet, exercise, you know, what you're putting in your body, your stress level, all of those things are in your control. And then you realize that you have much more freedom than a lot of people who are not taking ownership at that point. So that's one. I mean, we can do as many as you like.
Yeah. I mean, that's a fantastic place to start because everyone knows that that's worth doing. And then just trying to start wherever you are and start with baby steps. If you're not moving your body, then just try to, you know, take a 5-minute walk in the morning and you've already made that 1% improvement. And, you know, you alluded to this, you know, the theme of the podcast, which is the exponential part where these things snowball, you know, and so you build momentum starting with one thing. And these relate to other areas. So the health and fitness area, and you've talked about this too. It's not just about eating food and moving your body and sleeping. It's less psychological motivation to continue those habits and do that from a place of intrinsic motivation. You know, you mentioned Wes, he has a show, Healthy Mind, Fit Body, which is really addressing the psychological element, which is typically absent in the entire health and fitness industry, which is why you have so many people just yo-yoing and not feeling motivated, and they feel like they're forcing themselves to change their habits and using sort of willpower, and that doesn't stay in place. Whereas if you then start getting curious about the psychological realm and do that journaling, do that meditation, get curious about the parts of self that are feeling, you know, unmotivated. There's parts of self that don't want to go work out. Well, can you become curious about that and hear those parts of you out? And then maybe you decide, oh, actually, I think what I really want to do is a different activity. I really feel like I want to play tennis. I don't want to go, you know, do deadlifts, and that's more exciting to me. So that's going to be more sustainable. I don't like that word, but it's going to be more empowering and motivating when you get in touch with your intrinsic motivation. Right. And then when you start doing that, you know, you can really start diving into, you know, deeper parts of self and getting curious about childhood experiences, about why are you not motivated, and all these things can work off of each other.
Yeah. And introspection with a lot of that too, because fitness is a tricky one, right? Like I had a conversation with Michael Malice a couple of years ago, and you know, Michael Malice is always recruited to talk about like North Korea or some political topic. And what was interesting to me was like, here's a super smart guy. And he talks on his podcast about how like diet and fitness is a real struggle for him. So I said, I want to hear how, you know, somebody who's obviously, you know, has a very impressive intellect deals with a complicated problem. So we had kind of a uncomfortable conversation about self-discipline in that. But you know, one of his, like, as he looked into like the health and fitness world, he saw there's like a lot of unhealthy behavior there. Like the fitness thing is often a kind of patch over the work that people, that inner work, right? Because like a lot of, you know, the results of the diet, exercise, they're external. Or at least there's an external payoff that's pretty easy to focus on. So people are using it as a kind of a substitute for maybe some of the more important work that they need to do. And he said he made some declaration like there's a lot of really sick and crazy people in the fitness industry. So yeah. I think part of the introspection as you talk about using this to go further, you know, to engage in that inwardness about it is this introspection of why am I doing this? And I would say that, you know, as a young man, I was doing it for totally superficial reasons. You know, like I just wanted to look good. That was really all that I cared about when I started that, maybe like in my early 20s. And obviously, again, enthusiasm and commitment waxed and waned in the last 20 years. But, you know, I've been really serious and committed for several consecutive years now. And it's evolved for me into a kind of meditation, but it took asking difficult questions like, okay, well, what if I lost a leg? What if I lost an arm? And then none of this was a part of my life anymore, or it would certainly change dramatically from how it is in my life right now. How would I adapt? How much do I need this? What am I using this to? Imagine life without this thing that you love so much that some people might say you're obsessed with. What could this be getting in the way of, I guess is an important question. So yeah, being able to do that stuff and then discovering, and this is like advice I've given to other people who, you know, wanted to go on this sort of personal growth journey, is start there. This is, if anything, yeah, you'll get some aesthetic payoffs from doing it, for sure. You'll look better, you'll be thinner, you'll like the way your clothes fit, etc. But it's really a foundation of like how hard work produces results, even though you can't see them right away. Like your first day of journaling, if you do a real brain dump, you're not going to feel better after, probably. Your first session with a therapist, if they're really inquisitive and they're really good at getting to the things you're uncomfortable talking about, you're not going to leave there feeling better automatically. So it's the same kind of thing with this pursuit. And I think that, like, it took me a long time to understand what the utility of it was in my life, right? And now the things that were the primary motivators 20 years ago are side benefits at this point.
So if we could spotlight now, I mean, sort of related to that, another element of this sphere of control concept,
sure,
which is relationships. And I think perhaps subconsciously, I would conjecture that many people don't want to start on personal growth and become healthier because there's a fear of disconnection from their friends or their close relationships. Because if those relationships, those people aren't on that journey, then you starting to grow, become healthier and happier is going to put up a mirror for those people. And it can be uncomfortable for them, which could be uncomfortable for you because you have a need for connection and connect and friendships. So there's almost this sort of tall poppy syndrome going on of, I don't want to get to stand out from the group if I start improving my life. And I'm curious if you could speak to that, any challenges you've worked through in that arena, and also how you may have employed effective communication strategies. I know you've talked about ineffective experiences you've had communication wise earlier in your life, but you know, you've talked about nonviolent communication and negotiation skills, and you know, what tips or encouragement will you have for someone who is interested in growing, but maybe is consciously or subconsciously a little bit weary because of that relationship element?
I would say that it's worth doing a kind of audit of the relationships that you have, whether they're familial or they're friends or they're romantic. You know, I think a lot of friendships are based on a kind of, you know, legacy, location. These are the people that I grew up around. And I think that's great. It's just not something I've really ever done. Like, I'm not at odds or estranged from anybody I grew up with, but it would be... attending the same elementary school is not the basis for a lifelong friendship, even though I do respect and admire people who do have those kinds of those lifelong friends. But what are friendships based on, and or relationships in general, what are they based on? And when it comes to family in the romantic, but it extends to friendship as well, I would say if this is a relationship that is currently based on what we don't say, right, on this relationship, the peace in this relationship is maintained by keeping certain things under the carpet, which certainly extends to all three of those types of relationships. That's either something that needs to be addressed and hopefully remedied, or maybe that's a relationship that, even if it doesn't end, needs to have a lower priority. And I think the two most important things to build any kind of relationship on are, do I feel visible? Or do I have a desire to make this other person feel visible? And is there, you know, an ongoing pattern of understanding and respect? And from there, it doesn't really matter if somebody has the same political views or, you know, the same general philosophical worldview. Like, if a person has curiosity and a commitment to trying to understand, to see you, and you know, makes it works to be seen by you, I think that that's a foundation that you can work with. But if I was in a relationship that was a friend, a family member, or a romantic relationship, and a pattern of disrespect emerged, or a pattern of not feeling visible emerged, I probably would not continue that relationship. So I think if people find themselves in that position where they don't want to lose these, and I get it. Like, you know, I've been doing School Sucks podcast for a decade, and I've been involved in, you know, numerous sort of related movements around it. So I've met and interacted with hundreds, if not thousands, of great people and have lots of choices for who I, you know, who I can spend my time with. And I understand that not everybody is in that situation. So yeah, it can be difficult, but I really think for me, if again, like if a pattern of disrespect or a pattern of not feeling visible is emergent and persistent, then I probably wouldn't continue that relationship. Because that's you can't really build anything on that. And obviously we see that sphere of concern, or that circle of concern outside the sphere of control, at least at this point in our existence in this year 2020, closing in on that control that we have. And our relationships are in there. So we start to see things like on dating sites, people say, don't think you're going to even talk to me if you voted for Trump. People getting divorced over political reasons, or friends fighting over political things that maybe don't even affect them directly, and they certainly can't change. Those kinds of things ending friendships. So there needs to be that foundation of understanding, visibility, and respect. And then I think you can sort of negotiate through these things in the larger world that could interfere or put stress on those kinds of relationships. But if you jump in, if you want to say anything, but I think that if people are not ready to look inward, there is going to be a kind of, I don't know, discomfort in it. Like the first friend who says, you know, I'm going to go to therapy, or, you know, I'm going to learn about adverse childhood experiences, or, you know, saying to your romantic partner, I want us to read If You Could Hear What I Cannot Say by Nathaniel Brandon, or The Psychology of Romantic Love. That is uncomfortable, I think. So I think you have the responsibility as the person on that path to find the soft touch to broach those subjects if you want to broach them with those people at all. And I guess that decision would be made based on the quality of the foundation of the relationship that I talked about before that.
Yeah. And the need for visibility, I think, is absolutely primary. And you mentioned The Psychology of Romantic Love, and that's what Brandon really, you know, highlighted for me, was, you know, feeling seen is when someone understands how you think, they understand who you are, and they celebrate that, right? So if you are in relationships where you're not feeling free to say what you actually think, say what you actually feel, then are you actually connected to that person? Yeah, there's some element of sort of quasi-connection, because I think that's our biological programming. We're just being with people, talking to people. Your body is going to be glad that you're doing that rather than having nothing. But from a more front part of the brain standpoint, a self-esteeming standpoint, then you're not really going to feel connected. You're not going to be seen. You're going to be sort of alone if really in the relationship itself, you're not going to be free and open and honest. And it's like, well, what's better? You know, spending time on your own, turning inward, and having a wonderful, accepting relationship with your own self, or kind of disregarding all that and then just hanging on to friendships that are based on, you know, not really consciousness, basically, not honesty. And in my experience, you know, this has been a big journey for me, is trying to, you know, go where I'm celebrated, not where I'm tolerated. Go find people who uplift me and who see me, and then either let go of other people or, like you said, kind of deprioritize some of the other relationships. So yeah, I wanted to mention this topic because it's just such an essential element of all of this. So in our, you know, this last portion of the conversation, you did mention ACEs, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study. And I wanted to sort of dive, we can't go too deep, but dive into some of these realms of the inner world and, you know, healing aspects of self and examining and also processing the school experience. Maybe we can start there. Like you've talked about the idea of de-schooling. And there's a great podcast series, by the way, called De-School Yourself, 8-episode mini-series. that you were one of the guests on. And especially right now where there's a lot of conversation about school and education and a lot of disruption happening and people asking questions, I think this is a really important concept to think about, where asking yourself, what was it like for me as a kid going through 15,000 hours of school and how that impacted me, how I need to process that first before I can move forward, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where, this is sort of the template that we're given for a lot of our relationships in life as well. You know, just to add one more piece to the relationship thing, I think it was Brandon, when you're talking about like going where you're celebrated, not where you're tolerated, I'm pretty sure it was Brandon who introduced this concept of feeling lonely for yourself. That's a really good thing to be conscious of when you're examining the relationships that, you know, take up a lot of time and energy in your life, is, do I feel lonely for myself, right? Do I feel like I'm in some denial of self, or this relationship is maintained by me doing some denial of self? I've felt that way in friendships. I felt that way in family relationships. Unfortunately, you know, even over the age of 30, I felt that way in a romantic relationship more than once, where parts of me that were really, really important were just basically invisible to, you know, partners. So school's a good, you know, training ground for that, I think, in a lot of ways. You know, you look at, just let's tie in adverse childhood experiences there. Some of the people who've done, you know, the best work on this, including the whole IFS crowd, the book that I think we focused on most. It's funny, all the best series of my show for your audience involve Wes, because we did that. We did the ACEs series in 2015, Adverse Childhood Experiences and Resilience. So we were pulling from The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk, which has a lot of internal family systems therapy in it. But we were also looking at the work of this Dr. Pete Gerlach. And he identified these six psychological wounds from childhood. And certainly, you know, a lot of this comes from family, but school is just an obstacle course of unmet needs, especially in those really, really formative years. I mean, just think about it from a, like a simple physical behavioral kind of standpoint. Like, what should a 6 or 7 year old boy be doing? Is it physically or mentally healthy for him to be trapped in a desk? And this is just one, we're focused in on one tiny little aspect of that environment and the dramatically negative impact that it could have on somebody. But, you know, in that obstacle course of unmet needs, I think one of the things that contributes to those relationship problems that we're talking about is the formation of a false self, right? And I think the way that shows up is, obviously, you're forced to, even if you're doing it reluctantly from a very young age, behave according to rules that are for a huge collective, and lots of them don't make a lot of sense. Lots of them do not respect individuality or autonomy. And even if, like, yeah, we're talking about 5 and 6 year olds, so this is not just like, I understand that argument from a school management perspective. It's like, nothing is more important to us than that these kids feel free and autonomous in this environment, because I think a lot of, you know, teachers and administrators would see that as a kind of chaos, and it'd be very difficult to get them to buy into that idea. But you have to reluctantly follow these rules that are very much about, you know, denial of desire, of your interest, of what intrinsically motivates you. And the, I think the predictable outcome of that is going to be some kind of false self. And obviously that extends into the social aspects of school, where eventually, as we become our own people, and I think that process is delayed by school as well, but usually for most of us, it's by the time we're showing up in middle school and we're saying, this is my identity. This is who I am. I dress like this. I like this band. I do this sport. But there's, I think still for so many of us, a kind of a weak sense of self, or a lack of self-confidence, in that we need the safety of a clique. Like, we want to be individuals as long as there's a protective circle of other people doing basically the same thing. And I don't say that with any judgment. I think that that is, you know, just a product of this kind of environment. You know, I think that's also where we learn a lot. I mean, we're tribal beings for sure, but I think a lot of those tribal impulses are reinforced right there. But, you know, if we're talking about the de-schooling process and applying some of those adverse childhood experience lessons to it, formation of a false self, especially from a young age, even though I think this goes on through the whole schooling process, internalizing things like shame, guilt, fear, our reality being distorted to a certain extent, and being in a very low trust environment obviously has, I think, a really negative effect in that the setup of school, the setup of that environment is that we do not trust you. Somebody was telling me yesterday about something at their job and how there's this incredibly bureaucratic process for even checking something out, like even getting I need a book and you have to go through all this procedure of, you know, these signing these sheets. It's like, why don't we just have trust here? You know, like, we're adults, but that comes from school in a lot of ways. So I think that what comes with your diploma, as far as like buried emotional stuff, is you know, false self, shame, guilt, fears, issues with trust, and then maybe in terms of some kind of self-protection, a lack of self-assertiveness when it comes to getting emotional needs met. Where have you ever practiced, you know, by the time you're 15 or 16 years old, in any kind of healthy way? And what openness has there been to that? I think a lot of parents are better about that than school is at like creating a space to have like those sort of needs expressed by young people. But that isn't saying much, you know, for parents if they're coming in ahead of school, because school really, really, really denies that stuff because the environment has to, you know? So, I mean, I think that's a basic initial audit of some of the damage to undo when we come out of school. But I think lots of those things apply to the family as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is the gold, man. We're really uncovering the root of the inner landscape. And I mean, shame and trust are two big roots right there. I mean, yeah, like you said, the system, it's baked into the system when it's compulsory and you must attend. And there's all sorts of effects from that premise. So it says, right in that premise is, we don't trust you to learn without us, without forcing you to attend this institution. So that self-trust and that need for trust is not getting met. And so that's one route where in the de-schooling process, one can begin to examine that. And the shame, you know, if you don't conform and obey or, you know, fall in line, basically, then you're shamed, you're ostracized, you're a bad kid, right? The whole idea of a good versus bad kid, you know, that's where it's really tragic. And there's a lot of layers to unpeel. And this is really, really valuable. You know, when you can start with just kind of getting connected to that inner child, right? Where, you know, I don't know if you saw Toy Story 4, but one of the scenes that really struck me was there was a sort of five-year-old girl who had been playing with all her toys in the Toy Story world. And then it was now time for her to go to kindergarten for the first time. And she was moved. She was taken away from her toys and she was very, very sad. And, you know, that was touching for me because that's what happens to 95% of kids. Mm. And if you can begin to get curious and introspect on that five-year-old that you once were and ask yourself, how do you feel about going to school? Because it just sort of happened, right? Everyone just kind of automatically, unconsciously, their parents unconsciously sent them because that's what you do. There's all this tradition, just these feedback loops. Oh, it's time, you're 5 years old, time to go to school. Oh, you don't want to go? It doesn't matter. You miss what you do. Yeah. And then there's no sort of need for choice there as well. And you probably felt sad when you were 5 years old in one way or the other. And, you know, you can decide that for yourself by asking yourself a question to the five-year-old that you once were. Hey, how do you feel about going to school? And then you might actually have a therapeutic situation where you might cry yourself, like that girl in the Toy Story movie did, but maybe you've suppressed that for years.
Yeah. Or like I did. And I think that's, I've talked about that on the show. And I remember, I mean, I can close my eyes and I can see it, you know, I can see the darkness of the inside of the school bus, the tube, right? So it's like, I'm looking down this tube as, you know, I'm sitting at the back of the bus. It's September 1983. And so I'm like three quarters at least towards the back of the bus. And there's the darkness of the inside of the bus and the like the blown out light of, you know, the outside, the morning outside. And through the front window of the bus, I just see this brick building. I have no idea what's inside. I mean, I had been to school, like preschool and kindergarten and all that. But I remember this first day of school and looking down this tube of this bus and not knowing anything that was beyond it, but just feeling so uncomfortable with like everything I saw and seeing how many like other little people and bigger people that I did not know were accumulating outside of this building. I just wasn't prepared for it. And I just sat there on the bus and cried and said, I want to go home. And I don't know how common that story is, or even if, you know, I was certainly a very emotional child, and maybe other people that age were better at just sucking it up and holding it inside. But yeah, I mean, I would like to hear, I wish more people would be able to do the, you know, whether it's through like a Brandon sentence stem completion kind of thing, or I also did Jordan Peterson's, what was it called? Self-authoring, past authoring. And you have to divide your life into these seven epochs and talk about like the four or five most impactful events from each. And, you know, I had a wonderful first grade teacher. I saw her again when I was 31 years old. And I remember I said, thank you for being so nice and so understanding and making that like a tolerable experience, because I was terrified. But she was one person, right, in a giant system. And to a lot of the things that we're talking about, gosh, you know, I think the institutions are even the more finite initiatives that have the potential to do the most damage are the ones where everyone inside or everyone involved thinks they're doing good, right? Thinks they're doing the best thing. And that's very, very impermeable as far as like talking about like, what are the problems with this place? Like, who are you going to tell? Teachers? Like, no, no, no. We're doing the best thing. We're doing the best work. And how would I explain School Sucks podcast? If I could go back now and find my first grade teacher, poor woman's probably 85 years old. I think she might live in this town where I live, but say I track her down and we have this conversation, like I don't expect that to have much of an impact. But I think there's a lot of people there who would just deny it for other reasons, right? Because they're too close to it, or their identity is wrapped up in that vocation in a way that you're just not going to be able to do effective outreach there. Times however many million people are involved and however many million people rely on it as a place to take care of their children while they go to work, when that was a thing, we're kind of actually in an age of opportunity with all of this right now, where people are obviously second guessing a lot of things about this institution and the institutions that it feeds. You know, higher education, Harvard knocks nothing off tuition while everybody will be attending school through Zoom meetings. People are going to be very curious about what education means in this country, I think, come September and continuing on 2020 and 2021. So the people who are trying to project this stuff into the world are in a very good position, I think, to make a positive difference and maybe reach people we never expected to reach.
Yeah. And you mentioned the identity thing, and yeah, it's hard to persuade people who they've formed their own false self, which you also mentioned, and they have that guard up from the IFS perspective. They have that protector part up that doesn't want to entertain those ideas, and it's scary. So there's all sorts of the psychological layers. And that's why, again, you know, doing the work for yourself is the real work, and processing your own experience and taking away those protector parts or healing them and creating a sense of self-integration. And, you know, the ACEs study, you know, adverse childhood experience, is a series of 10 questions asking more about your household environment. But that's just a starting point for this introspection process and I'll link to the, in the show notes, the series that you did with Wes and I think it was Matt on ACEs. And that was like four or five parts, you know, it's like 10 hours or something of really in depth. And that's really, that's the crux of this all, of it all. You know, and you're going to be able to, again, bring that back into the world, the more healing work that you do. So, I mean, just a minute left here, but I mean, let's tie it together there. Right? What's your elevator pitch with, for doing this type of inner work, which can be hard and challenging and frustrating and uncomfortable and painful. How is that going to really circle back to building a harmonious world, you know, that we want, a world without all this violence and all this coercion?
That's a really interesting question. And I hate the
elevator
finale.
Pitch is too short,
yeah,
but
to be that I don't know the answer to that question. I just know that people need to return their energy and the focus to the things that they can control. And if people are at the beginning of this process, and I'm making a pitch for my work as well, one thing that we didn't talk about much, but I think was really, really the turning point for me, where, you know, it's not like I never slipped up or engaged in some suboptimal thinking or behavior after this. But the thing that really changed my life most significantly was understanding Nathaniel Brandon's Six Pillars of Self-Esteem, which is something that you can dive very deeply into. And there's a lots of related practices and reading material, but it is very much, a heuristic in practices that improve your relationship with self, your sense of yourself, and your quality of life. Self-esteem is talked about in some cases like a lightning strike or something, like a kind of fate, like, oh, I have high self-esteem or I have low self-esteem. But that's the outcome of action. Right. So learning what actions to take and to constantly go back and, as new challenges present themselves, like we talked about 2020 being a difficult year for a lot of people as far as like, you know, sphere of control versus sphere of concern crushing it. But to be able to go back and say, you know, am I living conscious? Am I being accepting of myself? Am I taking responsibility? Am I being properly assertive with my needs? Am I living purposefully? Am I, you know, in integrity, right? Do my actions match my words? Is a relatively simple and straightforward thing to do once you learn that material. Like, it's more complicated than what I just laid out. So part of my pitch is obviously to get people to listen to School Sucks. And I would say for your audience, that would be a wonderful place to start. I feel like the new strength that I got from practicing that made me a more effective communicator, right? Like it took care of a lot of unaddressed things in that inner sphere of control that I think were interfering with me being a person of influence beyond that. And that, you know, works as far as the show is concerned, but it also worked, I think, really well in my personal life. So if people are interested in healing the world, whatever that means, you know, however big the world is that you're looking at, whether it just means your family system or your community, or actually addressing or trying to be influential in a lot of these really challenging and frustrating problems that we're all dealing with right now, I think that is the place to start, is doing the work to expand your influence. And for me, that was the key. But I know you've talked about that. You've probably talked about that a whole bunch in your podcast.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you want to create world peace, then create inner peace, right?
Love it.
If you're healing these parts, creating self-integration and loving all parts, welcoming all parts, and you're grounded in who you are in an authentic way, then that's going to be the first step. You can't have a healed world without healed individuals. So it all starts starts with the self. All right, Brett Vinat, it's been a pleasure, and check out his work, schoolsucksproject.com, over 650 episodes going back to 2009, some really amazing series and really well-produced episodes as well. And Twitter is at schoolsucksshow, I think. And anything else you want to plug there?
No, that's it. If I would recommend that people check out our site, SSPUniversity.com, and our Ideas into Action Summit, where I try to take like a lot of the what I see as the most valuable content as far as like better acquisition of information, synthesis of information, and then using that information to persuade other people. It doesn't really have a ton to do with personal development, but it is a good collection and condensation of a lot of what I think is the most important work that we've done outside of that, on being more persuasive and more effective thinking. I would recommend people check that out as well, because that is the future of our project here, stuff like that. But I just want to thank you so much for having me on, and to be, you know, now in this feed with all of this other great content that you've done. And I'd be happy to do it again anytime in the future. So thank you very much, Joel.
Wonderful. It's meaningful to me, and it's my pleasure. And really appreciate your time and all your influence on all these ideas over the years. So thanks again.
Thank you.